Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing the second half of the interview I did with James Jordan, who is the new ballet master at Sarasota Ballet in Sarasota, Florida. In this second half of my interview with James, he describes how he got back into the flow and wound up back where he clearly has always belonged, and that is as a ballet dancer and a ballet master. He also talks about his discovery of the Tudor ballets and his passion to become an archivist for these amazing ballets. Also, he will talk about what's up next for the Sarasota Ballet, and I will play some music from that. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Is about being who you really are. That is, recognizing and honoring what is natural to you and for you. Resisting the temptation that is pressed on so many of us, maybe all of us, to be what others would like us to be, or what we think we should be, or what others think we should be, or what we were told we should be, or even more insidiously, to hide what we are because it doesn't somehow fit with those other requirements. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art because when you hear them talk, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And the interview I'm playing today, as I said in the run-up, the second part of the interview with James Jordan really demonstrates what I mean when I talk about being who you really are. In the first half of my interview, James talks about the fact that he really didn't discover dancing until he was 17, didn't take his first class until then. This is, of course, extremely late for a ballet dancer. But having discovered it, he pursued it with all of the passion and determination which is natural to him. And then there was this space in which he lost the flow. He talks extensively about the flow, how life simply evolved towards this dance career for him, and then the break. And in this, the second part of our interview, he is talking about how the flow came back and how he said yes and what that led to. A lovely return to the ballet company he had been a part of for 7 years and then was a part of again for 23 years. You'll hear him talk all about that and his discovery that the Tudor ballets were not being adequately archived, and his passion to do that. Also, he will talk about what's up next for the Sarasota Ballet, and I will play some music from that. So here now, the charming, diligent, responsible, hardworking, flowing James Jordan.
Todd Bolander called me and said, my rehearsal director is going off to graduate school, and I could really use your help. Would you come back and be ballet master? Because you know so much of the repertoire already and how we operate here, I think it could be a really good fit. Like I contemplated do it. I escaped that crazy world. Do I really want to go back? I have these skills now that I can do a few other things. Do I really want to go back? And I'm happy that I did, of course. And it was difficult. There were a number of dancers still in the company from when I was dancing. So suddenly I was in the front of the room and everyone else didn't know who the heck I was, and suddenly I was kind of, you know, in charge of a lot, and I was learning on the job. The ballet mistress Una Kai was still there, so I was apprenticing under her as she wrote schedules and was recording ballets. And you know, I had not taught a ballet class before, and suddenly I was teaching company class. I mean, usually people are teaching for years and are, I mean, that's really a very special thing to teach a professional company class.
But here it is again. Well, virtually none of the things that other people have when they get to this position, you are in this position. God, that was a convoluted sentence. But did you understand what I meant?
Yes. I hadn't really earned the stripes.
Right, exactly. But you don't seem to need to.
Yeah, I guess I don't know who gave me so much courage, but I got it.
Yes, I think that's right. I think it did take courage. It took luck.
Oh,
but once,
in spades.
Right, but once the luck was in, it took courage to say yes, to make the leap.
And a lot of work to stay where I didn't necessarily belong. You know, I had to earn...
Yeah, you had to catch up again.
I had to earn to stay there.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's something you had from the beginning. From the holding on to Grandpa's chair, you knew how to work.
Right.
No?
Yeah. That I got from my mother. She grew up on a farm, and, you know, that was a hardworking family.
Yeah, I was going to say, that is something you get from your family, you know. That doesn't come from nothing.
Right.
Okay, so here you are, back in Kansas City, in a stressful... But very, I don't
but
know what.
Familiar environment.
Yes, right.
I mean, I've been there 7 years as a dancer. So, right. You know, things had changed. The staff was bigger. The company had grown. There were more dancers. So I was on another learning curve, for
yes,
sure.
Yes, yes.
And I pushed on through. And at that point, Todd was in his 80s. And I said, if I'm going to... go back there, I hope that I can stay in this position long enough to earn those stripes to stay in that position.
Yes.
After Todd's gone. And so that was a bit of a risk. So
everything you've done has been a bit of a risk.
Right. So what I did was I enrolled in the conservatory there to finish my undergraduate degree that I didn't finish at North Carolina.
Yeah.
So I got those credits transferred, and I was the first person that department sort of worked with to help me continue working as a ballet master as I earned my BFA in dance from this conservatory.
God.
So, you know, they were, I had to pay for a lot of courses, and I would take some morning classes and summer courses. Some things I took from the community college and had the credits transferred.
You're piecing together a degree.
A degree. And some of the artistic classes, like I took the dance classes in the summers when I could. I mean, this was over a five-year period I worked on
wow.
this degree. And the one thing I couldn't do was the lab annotation class, because that was offered in an intense three-week period when they brought in a specialist and I'd have to just leave my job to do this. And that was not an option. So I took my lab annotation credit at my dining room table through the Notation Bureau in New York. So it was a correspondence course.
My goodness.
So
well,
that
yeah, you are nothing if not inventive.
Yes. So I managed to get that degree. My goal was to get that by the time I was 40.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was that very year that I got my BFA. And Todd was continuing. I mean, he was doing well. And, you know, I felt like I was doing good work and helping him maintain the company. But as he was aging, the board was really ready to hire a new director. And Todd was being sort of forced into retirement. So it was a difficult situation.
Yeah.
But they did, I had to hold down the fort kind of by myself for a little while. You know, there was a bit of drama and a few tried directors that didn't work and different things that evolved through the company. But I kept it going. And they hired a director. And Todd continued as an emeritus director. And so I served as sort of the glue between mm-hmm. Todd and the new director, William Whitener, who was a Joffrey dancer and a Twyla Tharp dancer
mm-hmm.
and had directed and choreographed. Yeah. So he was not a logical choice would have been a Balanchine dancer to have sort of continued that flavor of the company.
Since the whole company now has been...
considered a Balanchine company.
Right.
So none of the Balanchine people sort of worked out for various reasons. Mm-hmm. So suddenly it was Bill's company. And Todd felt okay about him, that he had a theatrical background and would present mixed repertory programs the way Todd had
mm-hmm.
with great variety. And so that worked, really, and we continued to produce Bolander ballets. I would stage them, and Todd would come in and coach, and we continued dancing his production of The Nutcracker that I would stage and Todd would coach. So I felt like I made that transition unusually smooth and nice for Todd that he continued to be a contributing member of the community because he was a beloved person
mm-hmm.
and member of the community.
And responsible for the fact that they had a ballet company.
Right. So he was revered and respected. And he was actually even had kind of a financial pension that supported him beyond his directing years. So it was really a good deal. So that all continued. So suddenly you know, I just sort of continue with Bill as ballet master, and all of that's happening quite nicely. When Todd was still directing, he was continuing to bring in other choreographers, and one that became an important part of my life was the ballets of Anthony Tudor. He had, in the time that I was away, he had brought in Lilac Garden, which Sarasota Ballet has danced
mm-hmm.
successfully. And so I missed Lilac Garden, but as I was back as ballet master starting in 1991, I learned Tudor's Gala performance, and we learned it from Airi Hunanen, who was a Swedish dancer who had worked with Tudor. And Todd couldn't afford to bring her back when it was time to present that ballet again. So Todd got the permission of Sally Bliss, who was the trustee of the Tudor Trust, to say, can James restage Gala performance, and then you can come and coach it.
Wow.
Put it on the stage. So I worked all summer. I had a notebook, and I had videos, and, you know, this was a big deal that
wow.
I was going to stage this Tudor work. So I really worked on that. And it was a delightful comedy from 1938. And that process went very well. Sally and I had met a time or two, but had not worked together. So we hit it off quite well. And that production came off very well. And then, just within a couple of months, San Francisco Ballet called Sally and said, the director there, Helgi Thomason, who said, Sally, I'd like to present Gala performance. And Sally said, well, I would like James Jordan to come and stage that for you, and then I'll come and coach your dancers.
Wow.
So... And, of course, so I get this news.
Yeah, it's the flow.
The flow. So the river is presenting itself again.
Yes.
I'm really happy that it's flowing. That,
yes.
That sort of bend in the road was a scary time.
I'm sure, but even then, you just figured out a way to survive.
I did.
Yeah.
So, suddenly I was walking through the door and in the front of the room at San Francisco Ballet.
Oh, gosh.
Wow.
So
I was really in the big leagues. And Sally came and coached, and all that went well. And meanwhile, other ballets were being brought into the company. William Whitener brought in Offenbach in the Underworld and Dark Elegies, and Donald Mahler was staging those ballets. And Donald and I hit it off. He's really became the senior repetiteur for the Tudor Trust. Just a very funny man, but very impassioned and detail-oriented, as, of course, he would be. And so I was just amazed that he was sharing his wealth of knowledge and dropping all of these jewels in the room, and no one was listening. I mean, the dancers were, and learning it for that one weekend that this would be performed, but, you know, Donald was in his 70s, and, you know, I just thought it was remarkable that it's like, I'm going to start writing this down. And I talked to Sally and said, you know, I'd like to learn from Donald. Are you okay if I do that? And she was. And that idea was in my brain when we were together in San Francisco. So I was able to talk with her in person. There I was staging a Tudor ballet and saying, can I learn more? And so I took this on kind of as an idea of the idea of it being my personal graduate school, that I would take on the financial ramifications of following Donald around the country whenever he was staging Tudor ballets, because we weren't going to be dancing them that often in Kansas City. I just couldn't wait till he came back again. So I was in touch with Donald, and we became friends, and he would let me know when he got a gig. And the companies were so fantastic. They would either get Donald a two-room suite or get me my own hotel room. Most often that happened. I would get a flight, and I'd pay for my own food. And eventually Sally would reimburse me for a little something. But I was really paying my way to learn these ballets.
Well, everybody saw this as a valuable thing.
Yes. There weren't many people who knew these ballets. And Donald was getting up in years. And the next generation was not in the wings.
Right. No, it was you.
Right. Who knew? And at the time, I didn't know where this would go.
Of course not.
Why should this be any different?
Exactly. You just, there's a, God, the river, and you're on it.
Yeah.
Okay, so how does this culminate? I mean, do you have a book, or just it's all in your head, or?
I have notebooks for, I've worked on 5 different ballets, and I have staged Offenbach in the Underworld myself for Milwaukee. It was a time when Donald he was not free to do that, so I sort of substituted for him, and that was my first time staging that from scratch. And Sally came and coached, and that went well. And at the university situation, I have staged Dark Elegies for Washington University and for the conservatory in Kansas City. So that's been my exposure to that ballet.
Wait a minute. So I'm just curious. The end goal of this is for these ballets to be known, so they don't get lost.
Exactly.
Right?
We're a very fragile art form that way.
No kidding.
That you can't plug in a disc and learn it.
So now they're all in your head? Or the ones that you've worked on, they're in your head?
And I have a notebook with maps and counts and a lot
of
words.
So do you publish this?
No, I'm available for hire.
Yes.
And that's how I got to Sarasota Ballet, because Ian asked Sally for gala performance, and she sent me to stage it. So I went, oh, great, I get to go to Sarasota for a month.
Yes.
And stage a ballet.
And guess what?
We all hit it off and just sort of mutually fell in love with each other, and we just had it all just sort of flowed, and they asked me to come back and stay. And I did.
And here you are.
Here I am.
So you can't live forever.
Right.
So what happens to these ballets?
Well, there's actually a dancer in Kansas City who was a principal dancer there who has retired. And she learned all 5 of those ballets from Donald Mahler when I was learning them, and she danced all of those, either core and principal roles. And she was also a protege of Todd Bolander. So she will inherit my Bolander and my Tudor notebooks.
Oh, okay.
And she is friends with Sally Bliss with the Tudor Trust. Her name is Kimberly Cowan. And Kim and I danced together for Sally's retirement gala when she was retiring as the executive director of Dance St. Louis, which was a presenting organization. So Kim and I have this connection with Tudor and Bolander, and that she is inheriting my notebook.
She's the heir.
Mm-hmm. And there are other Tudor stagers. We have Amanda McCarro and John Gardner. They were ABT dancers who worked extensively with Mr. Tudor, because I'm a second generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got
in
it.
In that I didn't work for Mr. Tudor.
I got it.
I've seen all the films, and I've studied and read and learned, but secondhand.
So you never published this stuff?
No. If you saw my notebooks, you'd see I've sort of taught Kim how to read my shorthand. It has some of the Laba notation symbols that I learned at my dining room table
right.
in that correspondence course. But it's all just, it's not really legible to the common dance lover.
So you don't think there's a book in this? Otherwise you have to keep finding people.
And that is the goal of the Tudor Trust as a non-for-profit, is to continue to have discussions with directors. Each time I stage a ballet, I try to rewrite the notes or to make them better and clearer. But somehow there's never enough time, and you're just sort of, you're adding in the margins and not really stopping to rewrite it in a better, more clear way. And hopefully there will be time in my life.
That's just what I was thinking.
Just that I can do that.
Right, exactly. Right. But now you are the ballet master at Sarasota Ballet.
Yes, and boy, am I excited about that.
Yes.
So I ended up being ballet master in Kansas City for 23 years.
Oh, my God.
Isn't it unbelievable? And this coming year will be the last time that the company will be dancing Todd's production of The Nutcracker. And I knew this last year before Sarasota Ballet happened.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it just turned out that what a perfect little ending that I'm actually going back in November to stage Todd's Nutcracker for the last time. And while I'm there at their black tie fundraiser, I've been asked to serve as the honorary chair, and I'll be given this pirouette award and profusely thanked for all of my service to Kansas City Ballet, and that will be my farewell party in December.
My God.
So when this came up, this opportunity with Ian and Maggie, we didn't know at the time, last spring, like whether I would wait and stay through the Nutcracker and then come to Sarasota in January, or how this would actually happen. But it turns out that they really needed me to come. So I came here the end of July, just as the Secret Garden was coming into focus and was almost finished by Will Tuckett. And they needed me to teach some company classes, and then the three-week Carreño Festival with the conservatory was happening, and they could use my help teaching there. And so I hit the ground running here. The house was, I found a house and sold a house all at the same time. I closed on my Kansas City house on a Friday and wired money and closed on my Sarasota house the following Monday. So that fell together.
Oh, surprise, surprise.
Yeah. And so my whole life was in cardboard boxes, but I was in my jazz shoes teaching ballet classes here. But Ian and Maggie were great. You know, once I did a few things, you know, I was working half days. They were just grateful that I pushed myself to come as quickly as I did. So they would send me away and say, go get settled. And, you know, then I would just teach a few morning classes and then go away. So sort of a flexible three-week period when I was just teaching. That was very helpful. Let me get settled and all of that.
I'm struck with how much you have to continue to learn.
Yes, that is my job description. I take care of other people's ballets.
Right. So you have to keep learning.
Yes, and making new notebooks. And,
yes.
And helping the dancers remember and helping artistic integrity of the work.
Yes, fascinating. I ask one more question. And it is, having given a life, and you have given a life to this work, is there anything you would say about what that's like?
Well, a total pleasure, my goodness. I mean, it haunts me that the responsibility, and I wish there were more hours in the day to devote to the tutor work. I love it when an opportunity arises that I can share that gorgeous work with dancers, because at the end of every staging, those dancers are better dancers, and that's just thrilling to be a voice for that quality of work that makes those people better artists. So how lucky I am that I get to play in the, you know, in the really top circles of choreography, that I'm really taking care of really such valuable work. And I hope to continue staging Mr. Bolander's work, whether that be segments here on the Conservatory Kids. I think he has a lot of valuable, wonderful, sort of dancey Balanchine-style pieces, but he has his souvenirs and his theatrical pieces, too, that I think can expand some young minds and challenge them as well. So there will be more Tudor ballets coming to Sarasota, I'm happy to say, and we'll see how all that plans out. There are some works that need some original cast members brought in for to revive some works, and Ian is very interested in doing that kind of historic recreation, and I've done that with Todd and a Balanchine work that was virtually lost. So
I'm having a reaction that I never have, and that is, I feel like, as much as I am grateful to you and enjoying this interview, that I'm stealing time from you that you could be doing with all of what you have to do and are committed to do and love to do and are passionate about doing. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I do take the time with the present. And otherwise, I could really just make myself crazy.
I'm sure, you know, I'm sure.
You know, feeling this rock on my shoulders at all times. And, you know, I have to go with the moment and be with those dancers downstairs on whatever ballet we're on. And, you know, we just sort of, it's just such a lovely team effort here. And whatever I can do to facilitate, you know, that artistic team effort.
Yeah, what I hear, I think, over and over again from you is the, what you just said, the commitment to be where you are when you're there and to give yourself, as you know, more than 100% to whatever it is that you're doing whenever you're doing it. Does that feel right to you?
Yes, there are times when I get pulled and I can't give my focus enough. So I get a little multitasky like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, something will suffer along the way and I have to stop and remove a couple of things from my list that I thought I could do also. Because, you know, all those studies you hear about multitasking, you're not really as good at it as you think you are.
Right.
So,
no.
So I learn every day about what's really realistic to have on my list. But I always have a list. I have a short-term list and a long-term list. And, I'm always in a panic about forgetting something or returning an email or getting people the information they need or just being where I need to be. It just so happens that I'm supposed to be teaching company class right now. Usually that's not my day, but somehow something got lost in the translation that one of the principal dancers offered to teach this class. I said, I have an interview now. I'm sorry, kids. I hope you still feel loved, but I just can't be with you right now. I'm going to go with this interview. And so they're taking care of themselves for this one little training class that I was supposed to teach.
Okay.
So that was just an incident where multitasking backfired. It happens occasionally.
Okay, we could stop then. Thank you so much, James Jordan. So there you have the multi-talented, dedicated, responsible, special James Jordan. And is it any wonder that they wanted him, jumped on him at Sarasota Ballet, and how lucky the people who get to work with him are. You notice he said, I hope you still feel loved. This is what he's offering in addition to his extraordinary talent and knowledge and wisdom about dance. He's offering safety, security, a safe environment, and a place to feel valued and loved. You can't ask for more than that. And so, in addition to hearing about James and how he became the person he is, I asked him to talk about what's up next for the Sarasota Ballet. And that's what's going to follow. And after that, I'm also going to play some of the music of what's next for the Sarasota Ballet. So here now is James talking about that. Okay, so James, you want to tell me about what's up next for the ballet?
I'm happy to. We have Sir Frederick Ashton's La Femme Gardée, which I have seen before on the Joffrey Ballet years ago. There are very few companies that perform this masterful piece of choreography. By working on it, I was really fascinated to learn some of the background about it, and it seemed like the music and the choreography is so intertwined. It's like that music, I knew it wasn't written for the ballet, but in some way it was so perfectly matched. And then come to read about it that John Lanchberry, the wonderful arranger and musical genius in London, worked with Ashton to rearrange Ferdinand Harold's score. usually for the story of La Femme Gardée, a Hertel score is used.
You know, this is something I don't know anything about. Are you saying that Sir Ashton heard this music and said this would make a great ballet and wrote the ballet to it, or...?
It's a commonly choreographed story of the wayward daughter, La Femme Gardée. And commonly, choreographers use a score by Peter Hertel. But Ashton didn't rock his world, apparently, because he went with a score by Ferdinand Harold. And then he started to work on it, and it wasn't quite right, but he liked the basic foundation. So he got with John Lanchberry, who arranged it and cut and pasted. John added a little bit of his own. He even borrowed a tune from Hertel back from that version for the clog dance. And then he intertwined some historic pantomime passages that he learned from other ballerinas and such from way back in Russia. So it's quite a masterful stew of historical and hysterical choreography, considered now the quintessential La Femme Gardée.
This is interesting to me because I know so little about the ballet that that this is kind of how it's done. A choreographer decides they want to do a ballet on a particular theme, and then they go looking for music that they think will fit their theme. Is that traditional?
That will support the story that they want to tell.
Right. And sometimes people write for a particular ballet, or that almost never happens. Do you know what I mean?
Often. The Secret Garden that we began our season with was an original score. So that was a team in London that got together, the choreographer and the composer, the dramaturg, all of that, because we had an actor, and, you know, there were many elements that had to come together, and I have to say I was really pleased with the outcome, and I think Sarasota was, too.
I'll bet that's very exciting to do.
Yes, it is. It's a little risky, because certainly a lot of money and time is invested in an outcome that you hope is a winner.
That's right.
And, you know, there are a few clunkers that have appeared through the years, but The Secret Garden was just a jewel that will appear and needs to be done continuously.
This is the ballet that's going to be done in December?
Yes.
The only one?
Yes, it's a full-length three-act work. It's marvelous. It's all hands on deck. It's a large cast. Everybody's in it. And we do a certain amount of our cast one, cast two alternation to keep everybody challenged and not working on the same ankle every hour.
Yes.
Cast
one, cast two. That means that you might see cast one on one night or cast two on another. Is that what you mean?
Correct. The same faces will be on stage, but wearing a different costume and as being a different character.
Oh, so they're doubling,
yes,
or tripling or whatever, right. Right?
We do that often here, yes.
To save their feet?
Yes, I mean, it's artistically challenging to do that, but also practical from a physical standpoint as well.
I imagine that it is artistically challenging because they have to learn more than one role.
Right.
Right?
And you're often doing, you know, those two characters could be on stage dancing to the exact same music at the same time.
Oh, my goodness.
And you might have to glance down to see what color your skirt is, to see what steps you should do.
As an actor, you come to assign the dialogue to the blocking. My mind knows that when I'm at this chair, this is the words that I'm saying, right?
Right.
So I'm assuming that the same thing happens to a dancer. This is the music, so this is the step that I'm supposed to be doing.
Right, and often count structures enter the picture as well. Inner dialogue about your character so that your action is truthful and engaging and telling the story on top of the musical structure so that you're stepping and doing the proper choreography within the phrase exactly as the choreographer wishes. And that's my job as a ballet master, is to make sure that all of those elements line up as the choreographer hopes they will.
Wow. So you're watching to see if the person is in character, if in addition to the fact that they're doing the right steps and in the right pacing, and right?
And particularly with storytelling, whether it be comedy or drama, there is always a certain amount of artistic license, or it gets too mechanical if they really have to do exact. So then you guide them, and you challenge them to make choices, and then you develop this trust with them so that they'll push the envelope a little bit here and there, and then you give them feedback about whether that was too broad, or like yesterday when you looked there, that made a clearer statement about what you were trying to say there.
This is like what the director does with an actor.
Yes.
So what I'm thinking, though, is that once you've got that down, and then it's the exact same music. I mean, if you lose focus for a minute, you could forget who you are. No,
yes.
I mean...
Yes, it's their mental acuity is just so sharp and unbelievable. And that's why we rehearse.
I'll bet. It's extremely challenging. I wonder if people who... If this is a well-known thing, I mean, people who go to the ballet know this. They know that the person who's dancing that role at this moment in time to that music may tomorrow be dancing a different role at this moment to this music. I mean, it is really, it's so hard, it seems to me.
But that's why people become engaged with an arts organization, because they, you know, with the Sarasota Ballet, they'll come to patrons or those of special interest to the ballet will be invited to open rehearsals, and they'll get to know the dancers, and then they'll find out what role they're doing that night, and they'll return and see that and compare, and they have friends who are just as engaged, and it's really can be so much more enriching to be involved in an arts organization to that depth versus just buying a ticket and skipping around town and seeing a show and then going out for a drink.
I'm so glad you said this, because I think this is so important, that if you're at all interested in ballet, interested in dance, that this is what to do, to become a part of the, in a way you become a part of the organization. Right?
Yes. And you watch these youngsters grow up, even through the school. You see them advance into the company, and they grow up so fast, as we know, and they become soloists and principals. And just to see their progress is so, you know, they do become, you know, your family.
You know, this reminds me of, it's an odd association, but one year, I bought season tickets to the, I don't remember if it's AA or AAA baseball team that we used to have here. And it was $70 for 70 home games. And you had the same seat for every game, right? And I went to many, many, most of them actually. And all the same people sat in that section and had been sitting in that section for years. And so they knew all the players. They'd seen them grow up. They knew their families, and they would yell at them, "Don't curse, Tommy," you know, and stuff like that, you know, and all that stuff. But really, they were so invested in this. They were a part of these kids becoming the baseball players that they became. And I imagine that it's similar here. I mean, people won't yell out, but they'll feel attached.
And I'm very impressed with Sarasota that they are as engaged in their arts organizations, and they're so proud of them, and they come.
Yeah.
And that challenges the artistic directors to really put their best foot forward and bring challenging work to them that they'll enjoy of great variety.
Yeah, people care.
Yes. It takes a village.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
So if you are listening and you have this interest, do you know who they should call? Or
I think on our website can be very helpful. Our development director, I think, and our outreach person can help. If you know of groups of children or schools, that we have Sarah Sardelli as our outreach person. She's recently retired ballerina who's just really charming and engages our young people in the community. We were very pleased that it came together that the Secret Garden was offered to many, many third graders as we shipped in busloads of kids for four performances the end of October. So we're always looking for those opportunities to share what we do with the community on every age level and economic level. Sarasota Ballet offers kind of an in-studio film series where the dancers are featured. Ian is the MC of these events, and they'll show video clips of the ballets that have been performed in the recent seasons, and dancers will talk about their experience with the ballet, working with the choreographer, memories, things that happened on stage, funny happenings, and things that happen with live performances. And they're charming evenings that happen in our studios. We're lucky to have Ian Webb and Margaret Barbieri at the top here, because they will provide a program that people are excited about, that they'll tell their friends about and keep coming, and they'll subscribe and get their friends to subscribe. And that's why it's so important to have that level of leadership at the top, because of that challenge is so great. You know, if we were just to put on Peter Pan every other month, you know, if we would just sort of fizzle away.
Yeah.
But we're always looking for collaborations. Our November program, we're incorporating the Key Chorale and singing one of our works by Will Tuckett. And those types of collaborations, I think, are very vital as well, because all of those choir families and their churches and schools come, and they're exposed to the ballet and say, hey, I think I'll keep coming.
That is such a great idea. I went to an event for the Sarasota Orchestra, and there must have been 400 people there. I knew two people there, and I thought, I'm so involved in the arts. How is it possible that all these people can be interested in the orchestra that I don't know? But that's what happens, is that people have their niche that they,
yes,
you know, and so the idea of bringing in people from another niche is, I think, very, very smart. Very smart.
I think that's been a good topic to talk about, actually, because it's true that you do end up choosing. And I've always thought there should be this subscription package where you get two from each of 10 organizations, and your whole season is. But, you know, I think it's just easy for me to think of, and it's more complex than that. I think it's a collaborative idea that's worth consideration.
Because I don't think I've ever heard anybody suggest that. Okay, so tell me a little bit about the music you gave me. It's a combination of Harold and Blanchberry.
So that's how that is identified, because it is a mixture of their work. It's very melodious. People will
go out humming it.
Humming tunes, yes. It's a charming story and quite funny, and two very different types of men trying to attract the attention of Lise, the lovely ballerina. And there's a Widow Simone is a wonderful character that is played by a man. And it was originally played by Stanley Holden. Mm-hmm. And he was the original. And this ballet premiered in 1960. And that was the year that Revelations was created at Alvin Ailey, just to sort of put that all in context. And I know that because that was the year I was born, so I just sort of paid attention to 1960 and the year that the new college was founded here. I see that on the sign as I drive to work every day. So it was a very good year.
Yes, and the beginning of a very interesting decade.
Yeah. So La Femme Garde began its performances in 1960s with a stellar cast, and that original cast was filmed and presented by the BBC 2 years later. So that's wonderful that that exists. If only that had happened to more ballets through the years, we would have better records of them. But for those who want to seek out that original cast, somehow that must be available.
So are you filming these?
We are, because of unions and all of that, we have archival records only, and we cannot sell DVDs.
But you have archival records.
Yes.
That's, okay, good.
Yes. And and Margaret Barbieri and Ian Webb staged this ballet themselves because of their experience dancing this ballet and working with Sir Frederick Ashton. So it's first generation primo staging of this ballet. It's gorgeous. The company danced it a few years ago, so we have a few returning people who are anxious to sort of get their teeth back in it, because it is such a charming and challenging ballet. It really is challenging for all groups, the women on point, lots of athleticism with the men. And it's really terrific. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to get it on the stage. It's a pleasure to work on it.
Come on out and see it.
Yes.
Thank you so much, James.
So I'm sure that, like me, you can't wait to see this ballet. And to cement that, we are going to go out on listening to several pieces of music from this ballet. And as there is very little time left in this show, I want to say, as I always do, that I hope that you got something you can use from this show. Something that intrigued you, something James said that you didn't know, or that you knew but had forgotten, or something about the way James's life has progressed that inspired you, stimulated you. Just something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and as always, I sure hope you will be too.
I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't.